Welcome back to the Everything is a Primary Source Summer Editions. I'm calling these Part 2 Palooza. We'll be picking up where we left off with the second halves to the second half of Season 2 episodes of the show. Daramy, the co-host of the Bigger Than a Game podcast, and I connected early in the football season, but our schedules didn't align until just before the Super Bowl. Talk about perfect timing, though, because the subject we landed on happened to be the very first Super Bowl back in 1967. Daramy and his co-host Jose's show is aptly named, as each episode proves what we see on the field, rink or court, is really the product of countless factors and events off of and away from those playing surfaces. Part one of our discussion, which first aired February 9th, covers this idea immediately and immensely, explaining what a major role television played in the upstart AFL's rapid rise to equal prominence of the NFL. Professional sports league mergers have happened before and since the NFL's turn that began with Super Bowl I. Just recently, for example, in the complete opposite sport from football, golf, we saw the merging of the PGA with LIV. It may be LIV, LIV, I don't follow golf, so forgive me on that one. This may have had something to do with similar variables as the NFL incorporating the AFL in the late 60s, early 70s, namely growing the audience. But unlike the football one, golf has long been an international game. Therefore, everything within that sport reflects the entire globe societies and cultures where football has grown specifically in and from North America and acts as a primary source of our society and culture specifically. So unless you're a diehard football fan, the week before 4th of July doesn't really set the scene to talk about the sport. But the second half of the conversation takes some significant tangents into a variety of topics, including Star Wars, it's Rebellion, so that fits 4th of July, Articles of Confederation. I don't know how we got on that topic, but we did, and that's a reflection of the Independence Day and Revolutionary War era, and grunge music, which I really can't connect to the Revolutionary War, 4th of July, but I'm sure that those people in Seattle really enjoyed the holiday. But anyhow, on to part two. What would you say about the audience of the first Super Bowl? You know, were there signs that there was a country already breaking into factions of like, I prefer the AFL over the NFL or vice versa? Or do you think that the audience was kind of like just football's football, you know, like,
you know, that's a good question. I believe it comes down to the region.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes down to, you know, what you had. And now some places you could get, like in New York, you had the Giants, the New York Giants, who were established. The Giants of like the 50s and stuff were icons, you know. Mm-hmm. Those guys, they were Madison Avenue, kind of like right there with the Yankees. But then you had the New York Jets and Namath and how big a star he was in the AFL. And so a lot of times it came down to what part, you know, of the city you were in and also what came through. So for us now, it's like we get everything. Mm-hmm. So we don't realize that there was a time where you got a regional game. Well, I mean, you and I, because it still was kind of like that when we were growing up in the 90s. Yeah. There was more channels, but still, like, those games were regional, what you got. So a lot of times, if I talk to my dad, who he's 70, and it was what came through. If he got the AFL because NBC came through on his TV more.
Oh,
so
okay.
He watched those games throughout the year. So he is lined with the AFL and other people. Like I said, if you have that hometown team, but it's what kind of comes through on your, it keeps, or people, we're not doing this on purpose, but it keeps going back to television. What you're watching, what you're being able to get. If you're getting the NFL on, you know, through the CBS package, you're watching those games. So you know those players, those teams better. You will align more with them. So there was that kind of fraction, a little bit of, you know, AFL and NFL. And you also could hear some people will talk about youth, you know, like I said earlier, establishment and the rebels. Right. So like a lot of people will say younger people liked the AFL because it was more characters, the colors like we talked about with the jerseys, more, at least it seemed like more of a passing offense more than what the NFL had. So there were, you know, fractions already with you know, AFL or NFL.
And we do keep going back to TV. It's almost like we're like can't get away from it. But if there's anything to, I'm already getting good ideas on how to publish this with my artwork for the for the episode. It's gonna be on TV probably. It just matches up so well with that generational. You know, it's kind of fun to think of, you know, boomers. You know, nowadays that expression, you know, is like people with, you know, the senior citizens. Like my parents just visited this weekend, and you know, they're in their 70s. They were born right after World War II. And so it's like we kind of matched up with, you know, gigantic tablets and, you know, their mannerisms of being seniors in the modern era. But they were young in the 60s, and they were trying to outpace, as every generation does, the one that came before them or the two that came before them. And if, you know, the NFL really, you know, picked up and formed itself in the 20s and 30s and developed in that was their parents' era. And that's when, you know, that's old news, man. That's boring. That's, you know, that's not what we're interested in. But now we have the 60s. That's when the boomers were really, you know, coming of age. You're right. They have that excitement of these new teams made almost for them. Like, this is your team now. You know, I go back to that with a lot of, you know, so you and I are about 10 years apart in age, but we both grew up in a time period where we were getting reintroduced to certain things in new ways. You know, that's a very broad statement, but I think of like Star Wars. Like, you know,
right.
We weren't there when the original Star Wars movies came out. Like, I was two when the last one came out. So I didn't get to, you know, I wasn't part of that experience of, wow, this is something brand new, totally different, like mind-blowing. But I do remember when they put out the special editions. And I always took that as, like, that was made for us. So we experienced the excitement that we missed out on because we weren't alive yet, or we were super young and there was no way we would, you know, be able to understand what was going on. That was made for us. And so it's almost like the AFL was perfect timing, you know, 1960, showing up right in that new era. I mean, that was a term that was used a lot in 1960, the new frontier, the new, you know, the space age. Like, we were actually going to, you know, eventually get off Earth. And, you know, so what better teams and different, you know, going back to what we were saying before, same game. It's not like they invented a whole new sport, but the way they approached it, their perception of it, matched that youth culture that had, you know, really developed itself differently than their parents had done things. And so, and they were a TV group. I mean, the boomers were like, you get that image of them as little kids sitting cross-legged in front of the TV screen with their cowboy hat on, or, you know, I assume watching a cowboy, you know, show, but, or just they like cowboy hats. And like, that's like the, you know, kind of mad. It's almost like when you get to the 80s and they have, what was the, I forget, they had like the Houston Gamblers, and what league was that?
Oh, the USFL.
The USFL. Yeah. The Donald Trump one, where they have these like even goofier names for teams. And that one just flopped. I mean, it produced some good players out of it that eventually went to the NFL, but it flopped because it was like, all right, yeah, it's the same sport, same rules. You know, I think they may have had a few variations that were different, but you're playing in the summer. Football's not summer, you know, even if it's, even AFL would agree with that it's like, it's a, it's at least end of summer, you know, entering into the fall.
But you know, what's funny is, and I'm not trying to make it political, but you mentioned like Donald Trump, he was the big name owner in that at the time. And you're right. We don't, you know, I think, you know, the difference with the AFL in the 60s and the USFL in the 80s, the AFL was competing and could compete. The USFL, everyone knew, was not competing with the NFL.
Yeah.
But for all the same, like you said, there's some all-time players who played in that league and came over to the NFL. The USFL could have survived and done well, but the difference is, like I said before, Lamar Hunt, the owner of the Chiefs back with the AFL, Ralph Wilson, you know, Al Davis was a coach and became a commissioner. Different people got together and, you know, Sonny Werblin bought the Jets and became what's best for the league, not just what's best for me. Mm-hmm. You know, the Raiders were going to go out of business in the AFL. Ralph Wilson gave the Raiders money to keep them in business, to keep them going. Whereas you go to the USFL in the 80s, their success, you know, Herschel, big name guys go to the USFL. They're getting bigger contracts. Donald Trump wasn't really about what's best for the league. Mm-hmm. He was about what's best for him and what he wanted. This was his way. He couldn't get into the NFL, so he could do this. And then he wanted to try to get to the NFL. And Pete Rozelle said, never, you know.
Yeah.
And he wasn't thinking about what's best for. And a lot of people will say, you know, Jeff Perlman has that book about the USFL. Like, Donald Trump's a big reason why the league didn't make it.
Right.
His selfishness and him doing all these things. So it's the difference, which we don't hear about or see a lot of people and coming together on a people with money or even people without money coming together and thinking of the greater good
right.
than themselves. Like, we don't hear about that now. And the AFL had that and the USFL did not.
It makes it almost that much more appropriate that the Green Bay Packers were the first team to win the championship, because they're like a publicly owned team, right? They're the only team in the NFL that doesn't have an owner. They're owned in shares by the working class community of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And, you know, that's and that's something that I think is in different time periods, because not to jump to the 80s necessarily, but actually, like a year ago, I did a podcast about Disney's Robin Hood, and mm-hmm. I was in preparing for that. I was looking at different, because that story's been around for like 800 years, you know,
right?
And in the time of TV and movies, you know, there was lots of stories of Robin Hood in the 30s. You know, during the Depression. And then, you know, it's kind of used a couple more times throughout, you know, in the 70s, that's the Disney one. 80s, no Robin Hood for like the whole mm-hmm. 1980s, because it kind of matches up with that, you know, greed is good. You know, the Wall Street, famous quote from that movie, Wall Street, or, mm-hmm. You know, the yuppie culture that just, you know, getting wealthy for, you know, and not thinking about other people. That it's like, yeah, that I guess if you're going to have a football league fail for that reason, that would be the time that it would happen, would be the 80s, you know, the decadent
absolutely. 80s.
You know, it wasn't like
absolutely.
The, you know, the labor union style, you know, 60s and 70s, where it's like, you know, you think of like a team like the Steelers, they're naming themselves after like the industry of Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. you know, and share the same symbol of U.S. Steel as their logo. It's not like that by the time you get to the 80s. And so, I can't think of a more appropriate matchup or team to, you know, to win the first competition between the two of them. Now, was Lombardi, was there a wave of relief after they won? And won handily at the end of Super Bowl I.
Yes, there was a huge relief because the Chiefs were a great team in that era. Mm-hmm. And they wind up, you know, a lot of these guys are core. They wind up getting a few more, got great players. Like, but they wind up winning Super Bowl IV, the last of the AFL, NFL, like Super Bowls before the official merger happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Chiefs win that. And win that handily. Like, the Chiefs of this era, coached by Hank Stram, you know, a lot of Hall of Famer, they were a great team. But there was a big relief. You know, the game kind of started off, the first half was close, and then the Packers kind of pulled away in the second half. You know, Max McGee, the receiver makes some great, you know, catches after being out all night. Max McGee was a big time partier, but he's, you know, winds up staying out all night and having the game of his life in Super Bowl I. It was a big wave of relief for Lombardi, you know, who was a very, you know, he was an emotional guy, hard driven, and the game wore on him physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. We're talking a lot of people, but it really wore on him. And you know, you can see how Lombardi looked at the beginning of the decade. So even around this time, you know, this is the next to last year, he's the coach of the Packers. He's worn out and he's physically, emotionally drained. So it was, like you said, it wasn't celebration like you see in current day Super Bowls. With that, it was more of a wave of relief,
because as being the, you know, the first time around, like you said, it was like there's a lot of weight on his shoulders. I think once you get into Super Bowl 20 and 30, I mean, of course, the, you know, the winning coach is happy, the losing coach is disappointed, but it doesn't have quite the gravity as the original of, like, because imagine if the AFL had won, if they showed up and, you know, the Packers may have even used a little bit of the AFL medicine against them with, you know, a stronger passing game and, you know, having a, you know, well, I guess a partier, I kind of think of like a Babe Ruth type figure, somebody that drinks all night and then plays the next day while still hungover.
Yeah.
You know, attitude. Yeah. If that's kind of old style sports of, you know, being like, you know, a beer and playing at the same time. Yeah, that's not weird. But, you know, that's like, I'm trying to decide if that was cutting edge or if that was holdover, you know, type mentality. But either way, had the Chiefs won that first Super Bowl, that first championship game, I wonder what would that have done. Do you think that the NFL would have still wanted to merge with them a couple years later, or do you think they would have, the competition would have gotten much more intense?
The merger already happened in June of 66. So they signed the deal to merge, and they said the first year the official merger will be 1970.
Okay.
So they were going to finish out the last four regular seasons of the 60s. So the merger had already been signed before, you know, before the season started of 66, you know, and Super Bowl I happened. So the merger was done, but it would have been interesting if the Chiefs win that game. It definitely hurt, you know, a lot of the Madison Avenue, the big market media guys, like the newspaper writers, they were more NFL guys. Mm-hmm. So I think it would have been of shock. It would have been of embarrassment. I wonder, you know, we got guys like ourselves who love history. We would have probably seen it as like, yeah, the Chiefs were better. But I think it would have been a stain on Lombardi's legacy. It would have, you know, really would have hurt. So, and then also I kind of wonder, because we see what happens 2 years later with Super Bowl III, and the AFL does win, and it's, you know, one of the great upsets in sports history. Mm. Joe Namath with the guarantee, and it's such an iconic moment. And then that gets lessened if they're not that first, right. If they don't get that first upset, and they the first AFL team to win. That's lessened because, oh, the Chiefs did it 2 years earlier, Super Bowl I. So a lot of things would change, and I'm looking at Lombardi's legacy a little bit and Joe Namath's legacy a lot if the Chiefs would have won.
It probably would have definitely diminished that component of our culture that, I mean, I think from the beginning, at least from the Revolutionary War on, of like, the underdog is the, you know, the our culture favors the underdog. We like it when the scrappy upstart, you know, like Rocky movies are fun because, you know,
I'm from Philly.
Exactly.
So
you love Rocky. Yeah. And you get it. And like in Philadelphia, you know, I think kind of represents that in some ways too, as far as being the Eagles. I mean, when they won a couple of years ago, that was huge because they had always been, you know, close but not quite there, and you know, and it seems like there's always that appreciation in our culture, in particular, for somebody who. So if AFL, which, you know, could be argued underdog just by, you know, fact that they were the junior, of the two leagues, if they had won that, it would have really kind of ruined that underdog feeling right away. It would have been like, oh, okay, I guess they're not.
Yeah.
You know, especially if they had dominated in some way. So it was almost like a play or like a movie written out where it's like, okay, the first couple attempts, it's not going to be that way. But eventually, you know, the scrappy underdog is going to show you know, up and represent.
It's an interesting point that you just made, Eric. And I wonder if it's okay, I can ask you, where I always saw it just like you said it, for the underdog. Like, America was built, Revolutionary War, the underdog, hey, you know, the American dream, and, you know, anyone, immigrants come over, they can make it from nothing to something. But I don't know if you know, Colin Cowherd, like the sports radio host, he was saying this. He still says it for a lot of years, where he's like, America likes the top. They like the favorites. They like the established guy. And he went to other things, but he used even sports. He goes, look at Duke, the Yankees, Notre Dame, you know, the Cowboys. All, you know, we look at the ratings that they get. And he was like, if you look at, you know, college, you know, TCU and some small other school, they're both two underdogs. You know, there's like, oh, that's nice, but will the ratings be there? When if you see Ohio State, Alabama, US, those established thing, Notre Dame, you know, let's see, when the Yankees go to the World Series, ratings go through the roof.
Right.
Like it, and so he made that, and it has me thinking, like, are we more of a favorite guy than I think? Like, I guess
maybe I'll modify that statement by saying I think there's like two parts to America, and there always has been, as far as like attitudes. You go all the way back once again to the, you know, Revolutionary era, and right after the Revolutionary War, where you have Federalists and Anti-Federalists. You know, the people that, you know, favored a constitution because of all the things that it did, and had that almost like elitist attitude. And the people that were like, I'm not so sure about this, didn't we just get done fighting a war against a concentrated power far away from us? Like, maybe we should probably be a little bit more cautious about that. And that seems to kind of repeat itself all the way through. You know, you get into, you know, the next century and the century beyond that, and into the 20th century, where you have people who will say that, I always support a winner. I love a winner. I don't care. You know, I want to be part of that, you know, status, that elite status, where I never even have to concern about losing. Whereas, you know, I think I know I belong to a group of fans. And, you know, I look back, if I was to put myself into that time period, I would probably be put into the more cautious of like, you know, yeah, this is a good plan, but, you know, let's make sure that we don't get too many people. I'll put it this way. So, like, you know, I'm in New Hampshire, and a colleague of mine, when we were, he went to a conference, he reported back to me about it. He's like, there's these maps you can find that somebody did, where all the different communities in New Hampshire, when that state was ratifying the Constitution, you know, put forward whether or not they were in, you know, that they supported it or not, Federalists versus Anti-Federalists. And he said all of the communities along the seacoast, you know, that had the access to the Atlantic Ocean, were heavily in favor. They wanted the Constitution. All of the people in kind of the backwoodsy areas away from the seacoast voted against it. And it was like, there's that divide. You know, you get to the 1920s, two Americas still again. You have the rural versus urban. You know, the urban elites have their culture and their, you know, all the different new inventions, and the mass media is centered out of there. The rural areas are a little bit more slower paced, and, you know, they embrace prohibition. They like the idea of, you know, let's go dry instead of, and it's like that seems to repeat itself in sports, where you have, like, you know, the teams that I played on in high school, like I said before, we moved around a lot. So, like, I was in upstate New York, like way upstate New York, in high school, and I went to a rural school. We had hand-me-down uniforms, but we were really good at football, kind of good at basketball, and pretty solid at baseball, and our rival school was, you know, for us it was a city school, a pretty small city for most people's standards, but they were like the elites, right? So okay. Like whenever we played against them, like case in point, when we played them in baseball, huge rivalry, because they would show up to the field with their like brand new uniforms. They, you know, in mid-90s they had like these reversible jerseys that they could, you know, and they would like put their jerseys out in the dugout. Ours are still like stained a little bit because, you know, they're so old that like the, you know, wash them as we try, they'll never come out. We have one uniform, it's gray, right. You know, we're using a lot of old equipment. They have the brand new stuff. We won. Like, it was always a close game. We won. The local paper reports it as Plattsburgh doesn't win. Like, they didn't give us the credit for winning.
Yeah,
we were the underdog, and we were like, what?
Right.
And we were so mad because it's like, and we were like the, you know, we lived in the mountains. We were like the rural school that we didn't get enough credit, you know, credit and stuff like that. And it was like, I feel like that's, it's always showing itself. It presents itself throughout the entire history of the country in so many different ways. And sports is another, you know, kind of microcosm of that, where it's like, you know, we're all, yes, united in that we're playing the same game, or, you know, we're in the same political groups, political parties even, mm-hmm. but you have some who are like, yeah, I always love the best. I don't want anything less. Or other people are like, yeah, I love it when a team, you know, works hard. Like I was just watching, and I have a sticker up here. Let me see if I can point to it. You know, we just finished watching the Mighty Ducks.
Right.
For like the billionth time. Underdog story. You know, it's like these mm-hmm. kids, they're wearing like, you know, newspapers for pads in the beginning of the movie. I don't know why they let them play at all, but bad officiating there. But, you know, it's like those stories gravitate, yeah. you know, to a certain segment of the population. I think I went on for about 20 minutes with that explanation, but that's I guess it's always there. It's always been there. And
because I think you're right, and I think we're a mix of both, but I'm starting to feel like the established, or like the favored, or however you want to phrase it, they don't need the underdog, but the underdog to really get that attention and yeah. be memorable, they need the villain or the bully or right. whatever. Like, you know, you look at, like you mentioned, the Eagles winning a Super Bowl. For us, that would have been great no matter what. It's that much better that we knocked off Tom Brady
right.
and Bill Belichick and the bad Patriots than if we would have gotten Jacksonville.
Right.
It would have been great, but it wouldn't be as memorable. It'd be kind as of hollow, it is.
Yeah.
The Red Sox in 2004 finally getting over, winning the World Series. If they come back from 3-0 against the Seattle Mariners, mm-hmm. great story. But not as memorable that they did it against their rival, the bad Yankees.
Right.
They'll be talked about forever because it was the Yankees that they did, not like, oh, yeah, the Mariners. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that'll always, like, stick out. And I feel like the underdog story goes well if there's the favorite. But if there's, like, a couple underdogs, people really don't care.
Right.
Really don't matter. Like, I look at, like, I've kind of been, you know, we're both guys of the 90s and doing like another, for the past year, like a deep dive into Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
And like kind of, and that's why I asked you, because it was like, man, how did they, you know, grunge? Now we all know grunge, but it really is an impressive thing that they broke through to the mainstream at that time in the early 90s, right?
Right.
You know, Kurt Cobain and Dave Grohl and all. And it was crazy that, you know, what makes their story big is like, when that Nevermind album came out, it didn't jump out right away. It sold like kind of okay, and like came out September of 91. Then the Christmas holiday happens, Smells Like Teen Spirit blows up, and what do? The album goes to number one, and who's it take down? Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
You know, like the biggest star in the world. And that's, you know, if it took down like, you know, MC Hammer, that's nice, but no one's talking about that story like that, where now people talk about, you'll see when they talk about Nevermind was so big, it knocked Michael Jackson off number one. Like 30 years later, we're still talking about it because he had that top dog, and it's impressive.
And that's another repetition of the two Americas, because by that point you have the corporate music industry and then the right. indie music industry, you know, and like that. And I think that you have segments of the population that, you know, gravitate towards either one. And it probably, if you went down a checklist, be like, yes, I prefer shopping at a independent, you know, record store versus going to Sam Goody or one of the bigger, right. you know, mall stores. Or I like to, you know, if I'm on the internet, I don't go to, you know, the regular, you know, websites in the 90s, like MTV.com, I'll go to something a little bit more, you know, I'll prove my ability to kind of search things out and dig a little bit deeper by going to some Correct. Other website. Right. You know, I'm just pulling these up, but it's like our shopping habits, our viewing habits, our listening habits and all that. I think you're right. You do need to have some indication of like, there's at least two Americas ongoing all the time, and mm-hmm. you know, you and it shows itself in different time periods, like you just said, with who becomes the biggest selling acts at the time. You know, are Americans in general kind of outgrowing Michael Jackson? He did not transition well to the 90s. Like, he didn't transition right. well for his pant. I remember listening, you know, I listened to Michael, you know, well into like when he came out with that album or that song Scream with his sister right, right. and I'm
with,
like
with Janet. Yeah.
yeah and I'm like, this isn't, he's trying too hard to match up with that grittier sound of, you know, he's Correct. Like swearing in it and stuff, and I'm like, yeah, you know, like, what are you doing? Whereas like Nirvana did it authentically. Like, they were not groomed by the companies. There wasn't some meeting where they said, listen, Nirvana, you know, you got to make your music this way and it has to sound like this. Where, you know, so it's like those two different, you know, little guy, big guy kind of thing that's always been there. That's a great example. It shows itself in music. It shows itself in art. It shows itself in sports. It shows itself, you know, in every capacity, really.
And what's a big thing connecting, you know, which is crazy to say, Nirvana and the Green Bay Packers, or Nirvana and football, AFL, NFL Super Bowl I. I never thought I would say those words, but that's why I love doing this, because it's cool. The medium of television, so that a lot of times it is luck. It's that time that you're in when you hit that right time. Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit got played all the time on MTV, mm-hmm. on, you know, first late at night, and then it just became over and over. It grew in popularity. You know, if that movement happens back in the, you know, 10 years earlier, MTV's brand new. They don't have yeah. that kind of, like, it's like people are kind of figuring, not everyone carried MTV. Mm-hmm. It's like that right timing. You know, if the AFL comes out in the 50s, do they have that? Or, you know, in the 70s even, is it like, okay, late. TV's new.
Yeah.
We kind of already established it. Can the AFL compete? The NFL has more time to grow. I don't know. But I think it's that timing with that projection in that medium of TV, or, you know, now we have the internet, but whatever that medium, mm-hmm. that popular way to present yourself is, a lot of times it's beyond our control. Is that it's other things, but then it's just, hey, you have a good right place, right time yeah. kind of thing. Nirvana had it, the AFL and the NFL had mm-hmm. it too in the 60s.
No, it goes all, it, yeah, this is TV is like ruling this episode, because it's all,
yeah,
it's all about it, because, you know, by the 90s, more and more families had multiple TVs in their house. And so the right. teenagers could be watching, they're not competing with the parents with what's on the set. So they could be watching in their own rooms or a different part of the house, MTV all day long, you know, they're getting that. Whereas, you know, in the previous, like you said, 10 years before, maybe two TVs per house, probably just one for most people.
Mm-hmm.
If you had cable, a lot of people didn't.
Exactly. So, a lot of people, yeah.
You know, you wouldn't have gotten that. And then, you know, same thing. It is definitely all about timing, because if the AFL didn't even show up till 1970, or it would be maybe a USFL story of them,
right?
You know, not being, you know, appropriate to the time, but like hit it right there in the 60s. You know, when the country is experimenting with, and they have a whole generation that is unlike anyone before them, with the boomers, and there's a lot of them, and mm-hmm. so, and they're like going to college like never before. They're having a lot more engagement with everything that they are happy to get, you know. So it's like, that's another thing I've found as a repeating theme in a lot of the things that I cover that we recognize and remember and can talk about is, you know, the best things oftentimes are like 1 foot in the past and 1 foot in the future, you know, the known versus unknown. And with like a football league, like we were saying before, the AFL, they were playing the same game, but they were doing it differently. They were doing it futuristically. And so it's like, that's why it had so much appeal. Like if it was a brand new sport that was trying to be introduced, wouldn't have. And I'm sure if we looked it up, there was probably new games that were introduced in the 60s, sports and stuff that never took off because, you know, nobody, you know, had any interest in them or it took a while or something like that. But it's like, they're playing the same game that had been around for about 30, 35 years up to that point, but they're carrying it out a little bit differently, trying new things, new logos on their helmets, new, you know, markets that they were playing it at. And that's probably why, you know, they're so memorable.
Well, and a big thing also, too, to add to that, where if the AFL comes out 10 years later and not like 1960, is two things that I look at as well. The on the field, the players and coaches. So twofold, a lot of the great, you know, we go for players, right? A lot of the great white players in the AFL were guys who went to the NFL and the NFL didn't want them. The NFL cut them, whatever. And the AFL, you know, Lynn Dawson, the quarterback for the Chiefs in this game, you know, he got cut. People didn't want him, you know, so then, Hank Stram in Kansas City, well, they were Dallas first, but then Kansas City took him on. You know, a lot of different coaches. John Madden got his start in the AFL with the Raiders. Different people got those chance. Hank Stram, the coach for the Chiefs in this game. And so you have a lot of guys for white coaches, but like players in 1970, probably maybe not as much of an expansion, but the NFL is going to be bigger. And do you have, can you get those great players to come over? We keep it just first for the white players, great players and great coaches. Do you have as much opportunity to get them now where there wasn't, you know, as many jobs in 1960? There's going to be more in 1970. Right. Maybe you can't put on as good of product. And then I mentioned earlier with race, HBCUs, the black, there was a quota. So in the 60s, the AFL, they tapped in, you know, Lloyd Wells, like the first really black scout in football history. He was a scout for the Kansas City Chiefs. He tapped into HBCUs. You know, black players couldn't play certain positions. The next year, the Chiefs draft Willie Lanier, a future Hall of Famer. He becomes the first black middle linebacker. Blacks couldn't be a middle linebacker. They couldn't be quarterbacks. They couldn't be centers in the NFL. That was like a quote-unquote unwritten rule. The AFL broke down that door. They got a lot of those great players from HBCUs to come in. And at that time, it helped, you know, the 60s, people are getting more comfortable. Like, slowly but surely, you're seeing more blacks on TV. Well, you know, it's not huge, but on some TV shows. Yeah. You're seeing the civil rights movement. You're seeing different people. So white America's a little more comfortable with seeing the black athlete than they were in Jackie Robinson's time or in the 50s. So it's that perfect timing where if you go to 1970, someone's tapping into the black athlete in the NFL. So the AFL can't go down that route and get those players onto their teams. So it's crazy how it's like you said, the combination of being a visionary and being risk takers, but the outside control is the timing. 10 years earlier, 10 years later, if they had that vision, it's not going to be executed that same way.
You know, it should be mentioned that we're recording this on Martin Luther King Jr. Day in 2023, and above your shoulder is a portrait of Dr. King and I Have a Dream, and we're talking about, you know, 1 year before his assassination. So he's very much, his message, his movement, everything about, and, you know, it's almost like the AFL was a reflection of that, you know, putting almost like the message of the I Have a Dream speech into their behavior, that they were doing that, maybe not like instructionally, like, you know, taking it directly from his message and like, yes, we'll do that, but recognizing that that is the important part of the times, that it was like, this is, you know, 1960s would be is 100 years after the Civil War, 100 years after Reconstruction began, and a great opportunity to identify, have we actually reconstructed? You know, because Reconstruction wasn't just about the physical, let's rebuild the damage. It was about rebuilding the society. It was, you know, and that's why I'm going to, on Wednesday of this week, I'll be doing I do like these week, I call them my weekly rambles, where I ramble like you've seen me do already tonight. But about, and so I want to talk about, the I Have a Dream speech and, you know, sort of the placement of it, you know, where they chose to give the speech. And it's, and even the speech itself is modeled, the opening of it is modeled after the Gettysburg Address, which was itself like a status report. You know, it's like they're in the middle of the Civil War. You know, Lincoln's talking about this new birth of freedom that's going to take place. You know, he chooses Gettysburg for the appropriate place to do it, because of how big that battle was and how, you know, enormous everyone understood it to be and how it was going to dictate the next. And so Dr. King takes the opportunity of the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. He's at the feet of, you know, below Lincoln, his monument. He's projecting his speech out to the Washington Memorials right there, and then the Capitol beyond that with a sea of people. It's even if the words of a speech are totally forgotten, just that like arrangement speaks volumes, and it like shows all the timing. And you know
it's great points, because it's all orchestrated. It's not by happen. None of that's by happenstance,
right?
You know, and that's Dr. King with, you know, members of the Big Six and, you know, and Bayard Rustin and a lot of people coming together to think that through. But to connect to that everlasting theme, what you name those images, what do we have that we wouldn't have had 10 years really earlier, wouldn't have been as great. We all can see Dr. King giving that I Have a Dream speech on television. Now, that's one of the great, maybe arguably the greatest speech in American history, some of all, you know, may say of all time. On radio, is it still great? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
How much more powerful is it that we all, whether you don't want to see it, whether you're trying to be off the grid, we've all at some point in our lives have seen, maybe not the whole speech on TV, you can, but we've seen some clip of him saying, I have a dream, and we can visualize it. When you're naming everything, I've seen it a million times. I can picture, you know, the black and white, who's around him, all the people, you know, even those people who I don't know, but I can see them yelling after, you know, Dr. King takes a break and come on, Martin, TV is that powerful image. And Dr. King with the civil rights was aware of that. And he used that.
Oh, he understood TV. And that was TV,
a big reason why the civil rights movement, he knew, like, using that image, that medium of television and using these mediums, how powerful they can be.
I think it's a perfect opportunity to bring it all home now, because it's like, could we even go out and say that the first Super Bowl was almost like, you know, or the World Championship was almost like the civil rights Super Bowl, you know, or the it was like almost like the that era's, it, like you said, it's a product of that era, and it could only have been in that era, even if the politics of the civil rights didn't show up at all in the actual game itself. It matches so perfectly of the 60s and the late 60s and all the, you know, because the assassination of JFK is what changes that entire time period. You know, the disillusionment, the hope for the future, all of that changes with that moment. And so it's like by the time you get to the last part of that decade, it's a much more cynical country. It's a much more desperate country. Mm-hmm. The civil rights movement had changed its appearance in many ways.
Absolutely.
And even Dr. King, his message had changed a bit in how he delivered it.
Absolutely.
Far more sense of urgency in his words and his, and you hear a lot more anger from him in his later speeches than you get from the 1963 one. So it's like, this Super Bowl is almost like the you know, 2.5 hour, 3 hour long depiction of that.
Interesting. there's some watershed moments. Like, I believe it was 63, the AFL had an all-star game in New Orleans. It was scheduled for New Orleans, and the way a lot of players, the black players, were being treated, where they weren't allowed to, you know, which we know about segregation and Jim Crow and, you know, colored and white, but the way they were talked to, treated, a lot of the black players took, they boycotted the game, and white players did it too, and they wound up moving the game to Houston. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was an all-star game, but, you know, we talk, you know, a lot of us now remember in 2020, the Bucks and the NBA bubble after Jacob Blake shooting, and oh, yeah, them not taking it, you know, going out in the court, and then other teams, and WNBA also, you know, I don't want to forget them, you know, leading that march and that charge in 2020. But you can look back to 63, where that was a big watershed moment of black football players sticking up for their rights and saying, we're not going to take this, mm-hmm, and how we're treated. The Super Bowl, you know, it kind of, what I'll say it is like, I don't know if it's that watershed civil rights football game moment, but it is a product of, with the AFL, them as a league, and they did it out of, like, let's be real, it a lot of everything comes down to money and, yeah, all that stuff. It was a business move. It wasn't necessarily about, like, equality or, you know, civil rights necessarily. It was about, we need players. Mm-hmm. How do we compete with the NFL? But Hank Stram was big on, you know, the coach of the Chiefs, big on, didn't care white, black. He would room, you know, a lot of times he didn't room white and black together, you know, depending on where you were, yeah, because he couldn't have a white and a black rooming together. Hank Stram would do that. So you look at the AFL there, you look at Vince Lombardi, who a lot of times that gets overlooked, how big he was and progressive when it comes to race, LGBTQ. You know, Vince Lombardi's brother was gay. Mm-hmm. And so he was definitely against, you know, he was anti-homophobia, yeah, you know, the NFL in society, even we still today, but the NFL was big. A lot of guys, if a black player married a white woman, you're blackballed out of the league. Mm. You're not playing. Lombardi was big on, you know, white, black, didn't care, come together. Lombardi had a player who married a white woman, and he was scared. He thought, him and his wife thought, we were going to get kicked off the Packers, out of the league. And people found out about it. And Pete Rozelle, the commissioner of the NFL, even called Lombardi to talk. And then Lombardi shut it down. He told Rozelle and all the other owners of the league, I mean, in the league, I don't care who he marries, white, black, purple, whatever. He's my player. As long as he does right on the field and does right, keeps out of trouble, he can marry whoever he wants to. And I decide who's on my team and not anyone else. So what I will say, to kind of like where I agree with your point, is it, you do have that, yeah, and not necessarily, I don't know how much of it is the times combined with also just those individuals. Those people were big. Those coaches were big on, right, how they ran whites and blacks together as players. And they were making a stand and a statement that was powerful, yeah, at that time and to this day.
So a good parallel, if nothing else, even if it wasn't a landmark event, it was a good, just paralleling the time. And I just got the 2-minute warning, another pun for my wife, but I think our shows parallel each other as well. I think we do.
Absolutely.
I had a fantastic time talking to you about Super Bowl I, and I, you know, it's rare that an hour and a half comes from, you know, I usually get like an hour, 5 minutes, hour and 32 minutes. This is shows the signs of two people that have good chemistry with our conversation, yes, and our interests. So Jeremy, where can people find you best on the podcasting world, online, with your show?
No, and thank you, Eric. And I feel the same way. I appreciate it. It was so much fun coming on here with you. So I appreciate it. You can find Bigger Than the Game with Jeremy and Jose for podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google, wherever you listen to podcasts. However, just Bigger Than the Game with Jeremy and Jose. And we do sports history. We do we'll see pop culture episodes there as well. So you can find us there. And then in earlier in 2022, we started our YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. So you can just go to Bigger Than the Game with Jeremy and Jose on YouTube, and you'll see some podcast episodes. They match up and you'll see a YouTube. But we also have some exclusive content that's just YouTube. And it's just on there. So we do a lot of like rewatches of games and different things like that. So you can also find us on YouTube, and we're growing that channel as well. So
excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for joining the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, where everything, including Super Bowl I, is a primary source. And we'll talk to you next time.
As you can tell, Jeremy and I love podcasting, and our respective shows are definitely labors of love and passion projects. And it's your support of our shows that makes us love what we do and want to make more of it. Be sure to like, rate, follow, and share our shows, Everything is a Primary Source and Bigger Than the Game, and follow us on social media as well. Until next time, thanks for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything, including Super Bowl I, is a primary source.